Blog Talk Radio.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strings. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire and a fire. Rivers in the seven games. In the government for hire. In a combat site. Let the weapons come in a hurry with the fury speeding down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, battle Trump.
And welcome to your place. I'm Starla, and tonight will be part one of Can We Lose Our Spiritual Foundation Through Time? If you're listening for the first time, just press 1, and we'll identify you by the last 4 digits of your phone number. We're going to listen to some recordings first, and then we'll break at the middle and open up the mics. While Bill's mentioned how his fortune business has brought him closer in his walk with God, well, we are at that silly time again when people are trying to tell others which political party has the mind of God. Tonight, we're going to use history, the history of politics, to establish our point. I think it was Ronald Reagan that said we could lose our freedoms in one generation. Wild Bill thought he would have some fun and entertain you while sharing actual speeches from our nation's presidents. We'll hear from William McKinley, followed by Calvin Coolidge, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Bill Clinton, and George Bush. This will be followed by a Clinton speech made in 2006 when he asked how we went from a great economy to the current situation. And we'll hear a little from our current president. And one of these speeches will include him saying we are no longer a Christian nation, a speech that he made several years ago while representing the state of Illinois. Then we'll hear on a current election regarding politics and religion. One of the guests is an atheist and the other isn't. I ask that you take note to the tone of these political leaders and the content over time. And if you study history, you know these things, but it is just that, history. The church has changed with the times also, and we're going to the source of the leaders of their time. In faith issues, we have the Bible as a direct source. Next week, we're going to take this topic to a spiritual level. So have fun tonight, and next week, buckle your seatbelts as we take you down memory lane and what the Bible says about this. As always, we look forward to hearing your comments at the end of the show and also at a mid-break. So right now we're going to hear a short clip from Wild Bill.
Well, hello, Starla. Thank you so much for reading the introduction for our show and manning our board tonight there in Spring Hill, Tennessee. It just blows my mind sometimes to think how we can speak to people all over the world and people can listen all over the world and get the shows from archives. And I was looking, I think I saw we had over 32,000 listens to our show. And so I just want to thank each of you who take the time to take a listen to what we have and post your comments, send us our emails, and go to our Facebook page at your place. But tonight, you're actually going to be getting part one of a two-part show. Tonight, we're going to look at the example part of this, and we're going to the world of politics. It seems to me that every time I turn around, somebody is trying to explain to me how one political party or the other has the mind of God. And as we've talked about on previous shows, I don't believe either political party has the mind of God. I think that the parties use religion as a way to reach a means, but I don't think they really mean it as far as a personal relationship, as far as God being making it going to matter is how they decide on laws or what they decide to do about how our country should be ran, or even so much the example of how they live their life we've seen in some cases. And it's just the way things are in the time that we live. But tonight, as Starla shared, we're going to be going way back in history. You're going to be listening to some speeches. The quality may not be real clear, so listen up. I tried to turn it up to where it wouldn't distort. Some of you listen on your phones, and I found that people on cell phones, a lot of times the music doesn't play very well, and some of the things we play as far as audio doesn't play very well. And I apologize for this, but when I go back and check on the computer in the archives, they usually come out very clear. But anyway, we're going to be, as Starla shared, going all the way through from the beginning, sharing things from history. There's one key point I want to make clear on this, and I want you to think as you listen to this, and you're going to hear some things that are going to sound really odd, talking about child labor and work hours for women, some things like that. And for those of us who live in the days of union and where we have rights to where you can't work over so many hours a week because a federal law has been made, it's hard for us to realize that there was a time when these things weren't in place. But the one key point to this is you get the tone of what each of these presidents is saying. And you'll notice that, and I quote Starla here from this thing that she used to say to me all the time, the more things change, the more they seem the same. And it's the rhetoric, even though as you get later on down in years, you'll find that the presidents become a little bit more wordy in what they have to say. But a lot of it just sounds a lot like the same rhetoric, just over and over and over. But if you really take a look at it, you'll see that the message is slightly changing as the rhetoric stays the same. And so, but I want you to see this. We're not trying to, you know, as I said, a lot of people like talking about politics, and it's the elections are coming up, and we want to stay on the cutting edge of the topics we discuss. But next week, we're going to take some of the things that I hope you notice here. We're going to have it open at the end of the show for discussion, but we're going to go and look at this from a spiritual viewpoint as to some of these same things that maybe the church has some of the same rhetoric, but things are not quite the same. So anyway, I thought this would just be something we could all enjoy, maybe a little education from. One thing I don't think I had Starling mention here is we have President Obama that's actually going to have some comments on the show. A few years back, some people were making some comments about where he stood up and said that we are no longer a Christian nation, and he did say that. And but it was sort of taken out of context. He wasn't even president. I think that's when he was the senator for the state of Illinois that he'd actually made this comment. I don't remember how many years ago. And then we're actually going to have a newscast. We're going to hear that whole speech, by the way, or the main excerpts from it had to do with religion. And then we're also going to hear a newscast, bring present time, talking about politics and religion and the candidates that are running today, and kind of bring up some interesting viewpoints on separation of church and state that a lot of people don't really understand what that means. It doesn't mean that we're supposed to have separation of church from state either. It's gotten to a point to where, you know, it seems like everybody has rights now except for the people of faith. And that's one of the things. I feel like I got an excerpt there from President Bill Clinton that I think covers that pretty well, his viewpoint on that. And I think you're going to find that very interesting. But there again, we're going to turn this back over to Starla in Spring Hill, Tennessee, my beautiful Starla. And we're going to let her go ahead and play these things for you. And then we're going to open up the mics at the end of the show for comments and questions. So, Starla, take us away.
My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government. Our creed embraces an honest dollar, an untarnished national credit, adequate revenues for the uses of the government, protection to labor and industry, preservation of the home market, and reciprocity, which will extend our foreign market. Upon this platform we stand and submit its declaration to the sober and considerate judgment of the American people.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control. I believe not only in advocating economy and public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment. I believe in a reduction and reform of taxation, and shall continue my efforts in that direction. I am in favor of protection. I believe in the permanent court and further limitation of armaments. I am opposed to aggressive war. I shall avoid involving ourselves in the political controversies of Europe, but I shall do what I can to encourage American citizens and resources to assist in restoring Europe with the sympathetic support of our government. I want agriculture and industry on a sound basis of prosperity and equality. I shall continue to strive for the economic, moral, and spiritual welfare of my country. The laws of the land are being and will continue to be enforced.
Our prime concern is that in dealing with the fundamental law of the land, in assuming finally to interpret it and therefore finally to make it, the acts of the course of the courts should be subject to and not above the final control of the people as a whole. I deny that the American people have surrendered to any set of men, no matter what their position or their character, the final right to determine those fundamental questions upon which free self-government ultimately depends. The people themselves must be of their own constitution, and where their agents differ in their interpretations of the Constitution, the people themselves should be given the chance, after full and deliberate judgment, authoritatively to settle what interpretation it is that their representatives shall thereafter adopt as binding. We do not question the general honesty of the courts, but in applying to present-day social conditions the general prohibitions that were intended originally as safeguards to the citizen against the arbitrary power of government in the hands of caste and privilege, these prohibitions have been turned by the courts from safeguards against political and social privilege into barriers against political and social justice and advancement. Our purpose is not to impugn the courts, but to emancipate them from a position where they stand in the way of social justice, and to emancipate the people in an orderly way from the iniquity of enforced submission to a doctrine which would turn constitutional provisions which were intended to favor social justice and advancement into prohibitions against such justice and advancement. In the last 20 years, an increasing percentage of our people have come to depend on industry for their livelihood, so that today the wage workers in industry rank in importance side by side with the tillers of the soil. As a people, we cannot afford to let any group of citizens or any individual citizen live or labor under conditions which are injurious to the common welfare. Industry, therefore, must submit to such public regulation as will make it a means of life and health, not of death or inefficiency. We must protect the crushable elements at the base of our present industrial structure. We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible, to provide for education and recreation, to care for immature members of the family, to maintain the family during periods of sickness, and to permit a reasonable saving for old age. Hours are excessive if they fail to afford the worker sufficient time to recuperate and return to his work thoroughly refreshed. We hold the night work of labor and women, that the night labor of women and children is abnormal and should be prohibited. We hold that the employment of women over 48 hours per week is abnormal and should be prohibited. We hold the seven-day working week is abnormal. We hold that one day of rest in seven should be provided by law. We hold that the continuous industries operating 24 hours out of 24 are abnormal, where because of public necessity or for technical reasons, such as molten metal, the 24 hours must be divided into two shifts of 12 hours or three shifts of eight. They should, by law, be divided into three of eight.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in social security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. we will do them better, and most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
It is 3 months, my friend, since I have talked with the people of this country about our national problems. But during this period, many things have happened. And I am glad to say that the major part of them have greatly helped the well-being of the average citizen. In the short space of these few months, I am convinced that at least 4 million have been given employment. Or saying it another way, 40% of those seeking work have found it. That does not mean, my friends, that I am satisfied or that you are satisfied that our work is ended. We have a long way to go. But we are on the way. We come to the relief for a moment of those who are in danger of losing their farms or their homes. I have publicly asked that the foreclosure on farms and chattels and homes be delayed until every mortgagor in the country has had full opportunity to take advantage of federal credit. And I make the further request that if there is any family in the United States about to lose its home or its farm, that family should telegraph at once, either to the Farm Credit Administration or the Home Loan Corporation in Washington, requesting their help. I do not hesitate to say that although the prices of many products of the farm have gone up, and although many farm families are better off than they were last year, I am not satisfied. It is definitely a part of our policy to increase the rise and to extend it to those products that have as yet felt no benefit. If we cannot do this one way, we will do it another. But do it, we will. When we have restored the price level, we shall seek to establish and maintain a dollar which will not change its purchasing and debt-paying power during the succeeding generation. I said that in my message to the American delegation in London last July, and I say it now once more. Our dollar is now altogether too much influenced by the internal policies of other nations. Therefore, the United States must take firmly in its own hands the control of the gold value of our dollar. And as a further effective means to that end, I am going to establish a government market for gold in the United States. Therefore, under the clearly defined authority of existing law, I am authorizing the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to buy or sell gold at prices to be determined from time to time after consultation with the Secretary of the Treasury and the President. This is a policy and not a mere expedient. I have told you the story of our steady but sure work in building our common recovery. In my promises to you, both before and after March 4th, I made two things plain. First, that I pledged no miracles. And second, that I would do my best. I thank you for your faith. Our troubles will not be over tomorrow. But we are on our way.
We have made, I think, great strides towards the objectives of the National Industrial Recovery Act, For not only have several millions of our unemployed been restored to work, but industry is organizing itself with a greater understanding that reasonable profits can be earned, while at the same time protection can be assured to guarantee to labor adequate pay and proper conditions of work. Child labor is abolished. Uniform standards of hours and wages apply today to 95% of industrial employment within the field of the National Industrial Recovery Act. We seek the definite end of preventing combinations in furtherance of monopoly or in furtherance of restraint of trade, while at the same time we seek to prevent ruinous rivalries within industrial groups, which in many cases have resembled the gang wars of the underworld, and in which the real victim in every case is the public itself.
Good evening. Tonight I want to report to you on the progress we've made and to ask for your help on our nation's most urgent priority, reviving the American dream by restoring the American economy. It's been at least 30 years since a president has asked Americans to take personal responsibility for our country's future. It's been 25 years since our government had a balanced budget. For at least 20 years, middle-class incomes have been nearly stagnant, with too many Americans working nights, weekends, and holidays just to make ends meet. For at least 10 years, costs in our health care system have exploded, while millions of Americans go to bed each night worrying that if they lose their jobs or their children get sick, their health insurance will be taken away. And for the last several years, our economy has failed to generate jobs, good jobs that pay enough to own a home, buy a car, pay the bills, educate your children, and retire with dignity. For too long, our government has failed to tackle these problems. We've been given the politics of entitlement, government handouts without asking anything in return. And we've been given the politics of abandonment, cutting taxes on the well-off and asking nothing of them in return either, while raising taxes on the middle class to pay more for the same government instead of investing in our jobs and our future. The result? Fewer jobs, stagnant incomes, a massive debt for ourselves and our children, higher costs and greater insecurity in health care, and a host of problems simply neglected. Well, tonight we're on the verge of breaking out of that old false choice between tax and spend and trickle down, between abandonment and entitlement, on the verge of a new way of doing things grounded in our most enduring values, a philosophy that says America owes all of us an opportunity if we'll assume responsibility for ourselves, our communities, and our country. No more something for nothing. We're all in this together. This means we must make government work for the people who pay the bills. All of us have been awed in the last few weeks by the vast power of the Mississippi River breaking its banks and the devastation that has followed. But we've also been awed by the courage of the flood victims and the compassion of other Americans who've joined them in fighting back the waters and trying to restore normal life. I'm especially proud that this time the federal government has been fighting alongside the people. That is what we must do on all fronts. We must do more, much more, to turn this country around. And now we have the chance to change. We're on the eve of historic action. This week, Congress will cast a crucial vote on my plan for economic recovery. In a comprehensive economic plan, there are always places for give and take. But from the first day to this day, I have stood firm on certain ideas and ideals that are at the heart of this plan. Tonight, I can report to you that every one of those principles is contained in the final version of the plan. First, the largest deficit reduction in history, nearly $500 billion, with more spending cuts than tax increases. Rather than the games and gimmicks of the past, this plan has 200 specific spending cuts, and it reduces government spending by more than $250 billion. We cut more than 100,000 positions from the federal payroll by attrition. We freeze discretionary spending for 5 years. We limit pay increases for federal employees. Why must we take extraordinary action now? Well, this chart shows you why. America faces a choice. We can continue on the path of higher deficits and lower growth, or we can make a fundamental change to improve our nation's economy by adopting my economic plan. Now, it won't be easy and it won't be quick, but it is necessary.
My fellow citizens, tonight is my last opportunity to speak to you from the Oval Office as your president. I am profoundly grateful to you for twice giving me the honor to serve, to work for you and with you to prepare our nation for the 21st century. And I'm grateful to Vice President Gore, to my cabinet secretaries, and to all those who have served with me for the last 8 years. This has been a time of dramatic transformation, and you have risen to every new challenge. You have made our social fabric stronger, our families healthier and safer, our people more prosperous. You, the American people, have made our passage into the global information age an era of great American renewal. In all the work I have done as president, every decision I have made, every executive action I have taken, every bill I have proposed and signed, I've tried to give all Americans the tools and conditions to build a future of our dreams in a good society with a strong economy, a cleaner environment, and a freer, safer, more prosperous world. I have steered my course by our enduring values: opportunity for all, responsibility from all, a community of all Americans. I have sought to give America a new kind of government, smaller, more modern, more effective, full of ideas and policies appropriate to this new time, always putting people first, always focusing on the future. Working together, America has done well. Our economy is breaking records with more than 22 million new jobs, the lowest unemployment in 30 years, the highest home ownership ever, the longest expansion in history. Our families and communities are stronger. 35 million Americans have used the family leave law. 8 million have moved off welfare. Crime is at a 25-year low. Over 10 million Americans receive more college aids, and more people than ever are going to college. Our schools are better. Higher standards, greater accountability, and larger investments have brought higher test scores and higher graduation rates. More than 3 million children have health insurance now, and more than 7 million Americans have been lifted out of poverty. Incomes are rising across the board. Our air and water are cleaner. Our food and drinking water are safer. And more of our precious land has been preserved in the continental United States than at any time in 100 years. America has been a force for peace and prosperity in every corner of the globe. I'm very grateful to be able to turn over the reins of leadership to a new president, with America in such a strong position to meet the challenges of the future. Tonight, I want to leave you with three thoughts about our future. First, America must maintain our record of fiscal responsibility. Through our last four budgets, we've turned record deficits to record surpluses, and we've been able to pay down $600 billion of our national debt, on track to be debt-free by the end of the decade, for the first time since 1835. Staying on that course will bring lower interest rates, greater prosperity, and the opportunity to meet our big challenges. If we choose wisely, we can pay down the debt, deal with the retirement of the baby boomers, invest more in our future, and provide tax relief. Second, because the world is more connected every day in every way, America's security and prosperity require us to continue to lead in the world. At this remarkable moment in history, more people live in freedom than ever before. Our alliances are stronger than ever. People all around the world look to America to be a force for peace and prosperity.
We believe in free enterprise at the Bush Institute, and we believe our economy can be more robust and therefore provide better opportunities for our citizens. We believe that one of the clearest expressions of freedom is that the aggregate demand of our citizens determine that which is produced. We believe that government is important, but we believe that government ought to trust the people, the collective wisdom of the people. In other words, we trust people when it comes to spending their money, and so should the government. Much of the political debate, and I guess rightly so, is about our balance sheet. It makes sense. I mean, yeah, when you look at the the debt to GDP is pretty high. Or when you think about entitlement, the overhang is daunting. But we believe that in order to solve the balance sheet, first and foremost, you got to grow the private sector. And therefore, the focus ought to be on private sector growth. And that private sector growth will yield increased revenues. The pie grows. The debt relative to the pie shrinks. And with fiscal discipline, you can better solve your current account deficits and your entitlements. This year, the Bush Institute, or this July, the Bush Institute is publishing a book. It's got to be a staggering thing for some of the cynics up here. I publish a book, and now the Bush Institute's publishing a book. They didn't think I could read, much less write a book. But we're publishing a book called 4% Solution. 21 experts, including 5 Nobel laureates, some of whom are here, have provided the content on how to achieve 4% growth in the private sector. Now, look, we recognize this is ambitious, but most of the experts believe it's doable. I mean, and so I hope policymakers take time to read what the experts think. I mean, you're going to read about cutting wasteful spending or entitlement reform or immigration reform, increasing trade, energy policy, and of course what we're here to discuss today, which is pro-growth tax policy. What's the best tax policy to grow the private sector? You notice I've been emphasizing private sector growth. I mean, the truth of the matter, if the goal was public sector growth, it'd be a short conference, which is raise taxes. But we believe that the best policy is that which creates a robust private sector. And so what does it mean? Well, first of all, it means that an understanding of how jobs are created, who creates the jobs. 70% of new jobs in America are created by small business owners. Isn't that an interesting fact? I mean, it's one of the things that makes the economy so vital. Most small businesses pay tax at the individual income tax level. Therefore, if you raise taxes on the so-called rich, you're really raising taxes on the job creators. And if the goal is private sector growth, you got to recognize that the best way to create that growth is to leave capital in the treasuries of the job creators. Secondly, if you raise taxes, in other words, if you let the, I wish they weren't called the Bush tax cuts. If they're called some other body's tax cuts, they're probably less likely to be raised. But if you raise taxes, you're taking money out of the pockets of consumers. And it's important for policymakers to recognize that all the doubt about taxes causes capital to stay on the sidelines. Uncertainty means the capital, the fuel for private sector growth, simply won't move. And before I left for the Middle East, I directed them to conduct a thorough assessment of our economic condition, consult with members of Congress, and provide me with their recommendations about any actions we might need to take. The economic team reports that our economy has a solid foundation, but that there are areas of real concern. The economy is still creating jobs, though at a reduced pace. Consumer spending is still growing, but the housing market is declining. Business investment and exports are still rising, but the cost of imported oil has increased. My administration has been watching our economy carefully. My advisors and many outside experts expect that our economy will continue to grow over the coming year, but at a slower rate than we have enjoyed for the past few years. And there is a risk of a downturn. Continued instability in the housing and financial markets could cause additional harm to our overall economy and put our growth and job creation in jeopardy. In recent months, we've taken steps to shore up the housing market, including measures to help struggling homeowners avoid foreclosure and to keep their homes. I also have asked Congress to pass legislation to modernize the Federal Housing Administration and enable it to provide additional assistance to struggling homeowners. The House passed a bill and the Senate passed a bill, and now they need to get together and get a bill to my desk as quickly as possible. After careful consideration and after discussions with members of the Congress, I've concluded that additional action is needed. To keep our economy growing and creating jobs, Congress and the administration need to work to enact an economic growth package as soon as possible. As Congress considers such a plan, there are certain principles that must guide its deliberations. This growth package must be big enough to make a difference in an economy as large and dynamic as ours, which means it should be about 1% of GDP. This growth package must be built on broad-based tax relief that will directly affect economic growth, and not the kind of spending projects that would have little immediate impact on our economy. This growth package must be temporary and take effect right away so we can get help to our economy when it needs it most. And this growth package must not include any tax increases. Specifically, this growth package should bolster both business investment and consumer spending, which are critical to economic growth. And this would require two key provisions. To be effective, a growth package must include tax incentive for American businesses, including small businesses, to make major investments in their enterprises this year. Giving them an incentive to invest now will encourage business owners to expand their operations, create new jobs, and inject new energy into our economy in the process. To be effective, a growth package must also include direct and rapid income tax relief for the American people. Americans could use this money as they see fit to help meet their monthly bills, cover higher costs at the gas pump, or pay for other basic necessities. Letting Americans keep more of their own money should increase consumer spending and lift our economy at a time when people otherwise might spend less. Yesterday, I spoke to members of the congressional leadership from both political parties. They shared with me their thoughts on the best way forward, and I was encouraged by those discussions, and I believe there is enough broad consensus that we can come up with a package that can be approved with bipartisan support. I've asked Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson to lead my administration's efforts to forge an agreement with Congress so that we can deliver this needed boost to our economy as quickly as possible. Passing a new growth package is our most pressing economic priority. When that is done, Congress must turn to the most important economic priority for our country, and that's making sure the tax relief that is now in place is not taken away. A source of uncertainty in our economy is that this tax relief is set to expire at the end of 2010. Unless Congress acts, the American people will face massive tax increases in less than 3 years. The marriage penalty will make a comeback, the child tax credit will be cut in half, the death tax will come back to life, and tax rates will go up on regular income, capital gains, and dividends. This tax increase would put jobs and economic growth at risk, and Congress has a responsibility to keep that from happening. So it's critical that Congress make this tax relief permanent. We're in the midst of a challenging period, and I know that Americans are concerned about their economic future. But our economy has seen challenging times before, and it is resilient. In a vibrant economy, markets rise and decline. We cannot change that fundamental dynamic. As a matter of fact, eliminating risk altogether would also eliminate the innovation and productivity that drives the creations of jobs and wealth in America. Yet there are also times when swift and temporary actions can help ensure that inevitable market adjustments do not undermine the health of the broader economy. This is such a moment. By passing an effective growth package quickly, we can provide a shot in the arm to keep a fundamentally strong economy healthy. And it will help keep economic sectors that are going through adjustments, such as the housing market, from adversely affecting other parts of our economy. I'm optimistic about our economic future because Americans have shown time and again that they are the most industrious, creative, and enterprising people in the world. That's what has made our economy strong. And that is what will make us stronger in the challenging times ahead. Thank you. We're at a critical moment for our economy. And we need legislation that decisively addresses the troubled assets now clogging the financial system, helps lenders resume the flow of credit to consumers and businesses, and allows the American economy to get moving again. I recognize this is a difficult vote for members of Congress. Many of them don't like the fact that our economy has reached this point, and I understand that. But the reality is that we're in an urgent situation, and the consequences will grow worse each day if we do not act. The dramatic drop in the stock market that we saw yesterday will have a direct impact on the retirement accounts, pension funds, and personal savings of millions of our citizens. And if our nation continues on this course, the economic damage will be painful and lasting. I know many Americans are especially worried about the cost of the legislation. The bill the House considered yesterday commits up to $700 billion taxpayer dollars to purchase troubled assets from banks and other financial institutions. That, no question, is a large amount of money. We're also dealing with a large problem. But to put that in perspective, the drop in the stock market yesterday represented more than $1 trillion in losses. Furthermore, both the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management and Budget expect that the legislation considered would ultimately cost the taxpayer far less than the $700 billion, because the government would be purchasing troubled assets and selling them once the market recovers. It is likely that many of the assets would go up in value over time. Ultimately, we expect that much, if not all, of the tax dollars we invest will be paid back. As much as we might wish the situation were different, our country is not facing a choice between government action and the smooth functioning of the free market. We're facing a choice between action and the real prospect of economic hardship for millions of Americans, for the financial security of every American. Congress must act. My administration will continue to work closely with leaders of both parties on Capitol Hill. I appreciate their determined efforts. While Congress is out today for the Jewish holiday, my administration will be talking to congressional leaders today about how we can move legislation forward when members begin returning to the Capitol tomorrow. Our economy is depending on decisive action from the government. The sooner we address the problem, the sooner we can get back on the path of growth and job creation. This is what elected leaders owe the American people, and I'm confident we'll deliver.
Well, I'm going to open up the mics, and if anybody has a comment. Blog Talk Mom, are you there?
I am here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, and I just appreciate this program. I guess several weeks ago, I went to the library, and it's free, the DVDs of documentaries about, I think I had about five different Abraham Lincoln, the everything that surrounded his life and when he was president, and one on Clinton and one on Kennedy, President Kennedy, and I was so, I tell you, some of them, it was so fascinating to me, the struggles that they had to go through in their own private life, and then the opposition that came against them when they were in office, and the fortitude that they showed, it was amazing to me. And so this is very good. I think it would be good if people would go to their public library and just look at the history, as Wild Bill was saying. History will tell us a lot. I mean, a lot more than rhetoric. If you look at exactly what has happened and transpired through the years. So, Starla, I think this was very, very good. And I hope others will call in and give some intelligent, when I say intelligent, you hear so many blaming and complaining statements about our government, about our country, about our presidents, about our leaders. And I guess it was sort of amusing the other day. There was a big, huge truck, a pickup truck in front of me, and it had a very vulgar remark about our president on there. And his truck was filthy. I mean, it looked like it hadn't been washed or cleaned or detailed or anything else, sort of a newer truck. And I thought, you know, it'd be really great if someone that's going to say something like that about the president of the United States could wash their truck. You know, it's funny in a way, but it's so very sad to see people. I've been in stores and overheard people that, you know, they weren't even clean. Their bodies weren't. I mean, their clothes, they manifested I don't mean to be mean to them either, but they've got all these grand opinions on what they would do. And like we've heard, that doesn't get us anywhere. We've got to pull together. The only way that it will work is for us each to take responsibility. And Kennedy, I believe it was him that said, don't ask what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And well, if we get that frame of mind, don't look for every loophole, but look to there's blessing. And I love the idea of mentioning, too, the Jewish New Year, the Jewish holiday, because they claim each year that the blessing comes from being good to your fellow man. Of course, you know, they're not perfect by long shot in ways that we could sure point out, but certain principles work. They'll always work. And it's positive principles, what I'm talking about, giving, caring, being responsible, listening. These are things that each of us would probably do a lot better just to listen, you know, and then make our decisions not necessarily on a political rhetoric or resume or whatever, but on definite leading of the person that's running for the office. That's my opinion, ever, whatever it's worth on that. But I do appreciate it, Starla. I appreciate it a lot. Hope others will call in and say something.
Well, we appreciate you so much, Blog Talk Mom, and we do enjoy your opinion.
Well, if anybody hasn't looked at the documentary on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they have missed something. I believe he was reelected 3 times. And the thing that really made an impression on me, Sister Starla, was that the media, you know, he was in a wheelchair. He'd had polio. Or infantile paralysis, one of those diseases. And he was paralyzed. And he suffered a lot of pain. And he went to a lot of trouble to be strong for the American people. When he would stand and he would give his speeches in a full body brace, and so was Kennedy. In fact, they said Kennedy would not have been killed if he had not had on a full body brace that day, because the first shot just grazed his neck, but he couldn't move because, you know, he dubbed the brace. But they pushed past all of these things, and they loved America and loved the American public. And it's just, I want to be grateful. I want to truly be grateful for men, and especially like I mentioned about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The media never, ever, ever, ever tried to get a picture of him in a compromising, ugly position. They could have, but I'm saying that because it seems like our media wants to point out everything contrary and obnoxious that they can. And
yes,
just so against the principles of victory. You know, what if everybody went out on a battlefield and they began to, well, Battalion 1, we don't really like the way that you're looking, even though you're on the same team. I believe I'll shoot you down. You know, and that's just such a simple thing. And we've had some grand, grand leaders. And for one, to whoever would like to shoot me down, I've been told that I'm going to hell because I really like Obama. I really do. I think he has withstood the test. And one of the speeches that Wild Bill had on the program a few months back really blessed me and put to silence a lot of things that I'd heard about him. So he, you know, he would be my choice of, I think he's a grand person and his family. Just to withstand, this is sort of amusing, I guess, but I've had a little bout with what's probably West Nile virus, and, it comes from a mosquito. And so every time I go outside, Sister Starla, I'm paranoid that there's going to be a mosquito, one tiny little mosquito that bites me. And I noticed that it was influencing a tremendous amount of my thought life. Can you imagine being president of the United States and have all of these things come against you, so many opinions and decisions and rebukes and misunderstandings, and yet you stand true and you stand firm and you do what, really, you do what's right. And I think if we would appreciate our leadership and pull, just the fact that we understand that our thoughts have great energy. I mean, just a thought. I've illustrated this many times with people. I'll be talking because we've had an outbreak of lice in the trailer park behind us, and I'll share that very briefly, and immediately there'll be half a dozen people start scratching their head. And not because they have lice, but because I made a mention of something that brought that energy and that thought and triggered all of those different things that they had faced. And so since we know that, then shouldn't we be putting every positive thought and prayer and decision towards the person that's driving the car? You know, I can't see any wisdom in attacking the person that's in the highest office. But again, that's maybe one of the reasons America is great. We have that freedom, we have that liberty, and so that in itself is a positive thing. So I don't mean to sound like I'm this grand authority, but I just, at 72, you feel like everybody's got to get on the same page, not with me, but with each other. There would be great strength to overcome the many, many needs that there are in the lives of the people all over the world, not just the United States. We are so blessed, so in so
yes,
many ways. There's a great Bible teacher that has written many, many books, and she said that when she was going through one of her hardest trials, before she would ever leave her bedroom in the morning, she would thank God for 100 things. If it was the bed, the pillow, the bedclothes, you know, just begin to thank God. And that attitude of gratitude brought her through, and it'll bring our nation through and combine families and do so many miraculous things. Now, I'm going to hush. I didn't mean to talk so much.
Oh, well, we enjoy hearing from you always.
Well, thank
you. You really add something to our show, and you really appreciate it.
Well, that's wonderful. I need a deer. And on that note, and again, I want to encourage people to go to their public library and check out these DVDs of our history. The Great Depression, First World War, Second World War, the things that our country came through, and the programs that were established. It was very encouraging to me. Abraham Lincoln, but then, you know, you have to look at the fact that some of these awesome people were, with Kennedy, with President Kennedy and Abraham Lincoln, they were assassinated. And for whatever reason, for whatever force that there was, whatever power that would do that, it's still here. It's still to be dealt with. And it's very, very important that we be, I believe, extremely acutely alert before this election. There's another documentary that I've been, it's 2012, Time for Hell. Well, everything about it is very informative. And we're moving right now. We're moving for some situations that we need to all be united and be on the same page. There's a lot happening in our world. All right.
Well, Blog Talk Mom, we have a few more clips that we want to hear from if we don't have any other callers. I'll just go straight to the clip.
Okay.
Let me ask you something. Wherever you live in Iowa, when's the last time you put the muscle on your banker? I mean, really, when's the last time you tried to push your banker around? You got to get a farm loan every year. Or you want to expand your small business. This is not rocket science, folks. These are decisions that were made. And people don't connect the dots, but they know deep down inside there is something wrong. The other day I was in Pennsylvania campaigning for one of our candidates for Congress who served me on the National Security Council and retired from the Navy as a 3-star admiral, having commanded an aircraft carrier battle group. And he got up in his rally and he said, "Mr. President, tell us what happened. How do we get in this fix?" So briefly, this is what happened. And I'm going to say something that's heresy at a Democratic dinner. You cannot blame the entire Republican Party for this. For this reason, the entire government of the United States, the Congress, the White House, and increasingly the courts for the last 6 years has been in the total control, not of the Republican Party, but of the most ideological, the most right-wing, the most extreme sliver of the Republican Party. As kids say, this is not your granddad's Republican Party. These are not the people that believed in a balanced budget and believed things ought to be handled first at the local level and only at the national level, if the local level couldn't be done. They'd like to sit down and argue with the Democrats and go over the evidence and try to reach a common sense conclusion and how to balance. That's not who these folks are. They have three primary priorities. Number one is the concentration of wealth. In 2005, the incomes of the top 1% of Americans increased 12.5%. The incomes of the bottom 99% increased 1.5%, which means the bottom half declined. So they have succeeded in that. Now, in 2006, and you can ask Tom Harkin and Leonard Boswell if you doubt this, when Democrats tried to get more done on Homeland Security, we were told we can't afford it. We got a big deficit. When we tried to restore cuts in college loans, we were told we can't afford it. We got a big deficit. When we tried to give a bonus to the Iraq soldiers, we were told we can't afford to give those soldiers a bonus, even though they were overstretched. When they raised the cost of veterans' health care, they said we got to do it. We got a big deficit. What was their number one priority? It's getting rid of the estate tax to help 8,000 families. Now, look, I come from a farming state, and I know every farmer dreads having his farm tax that he wants to give to his kids. But the truth is that less than 1% of the American people are subject to the estate tax today. We raised the ceiling on the estate tax when I was president. Every Democrat supported it. Nobody wants it to be confiscatory. That's not what's going on. 8,000 people, they wanted to give, let me tell you how much, $250 billion over 10 years. $25 billion a year, several times the amount it would take to give the soldiers a bonus, restore the college aid cut, implement the 9/11 recommendations. Several times. They're interested in the concentration of wealth. That's their goal. And let me tell you, every time I say this, they say, there he goes playing class warfare. That's not true. Listen to what your Middle Western neighbor Warren Buffett said. Warren Buffett said, the Republicans brought class warfare to America, and my class won. This is not about class warfare. Look, I've been rich and I've been poor. I like being rich better. But nobody makes me live in America, and I think I ought to pay my fair share. And I resent the fact I don't need another house. I don't need another vacation. I've got two college roommates that had a combined three kids that did a combined six tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And thank God they were not killed. My daughter's best male friend growing up likes to say he's the only liberal democratic Jewish captain in the Marine Corps. He won the Bronze Star for valor in Iraq. I resent the fact that I was not given a chance to support those kids who put their lives on the line for this country. I resented it. It was wrong. And by the way, if you look at the numbers, you'll see more millionaires and billionaires were created when I was president than when they were. The only difference is the middle class was growing too, and poverty was going down. This is not an anti-rich thing. This is about what America's about. America was made great by the middle class. And as long as we got a strong middle class and people can work their way out of poverty, there'll be plenty of opportunities for people to make all the money in the wide world. Right, so that's their first priority. Their second priority is unlimited and unaccountable executive power in Washington. Now, let me remind you of something. Any serious student of American history will tell you that the primary motivation of the founding fathers to break away from England, to have a written constitution, to have a Bill of Rights, was to prevent unlimited, unaccountable power, which would inevitably be abused. And yet, this national intelligence estimate that came out saying that our current policy in Iraq had made more terrorists than it had killed or jailed, they tried to keep that secret. They tried to keep their energy machinations secret. They tried to gag the guy that wanted to tell the truth about what the drug bill had cost. And I can't even remember all the things they've done. You ask Tom or Leonard, they'll tell you there's never been a more secretive, unaccountable administration. And if you seek to hold them accountable, they act like you really don't care about fighting the war on terror. And I could give you lots and lots of other examples. The third thing they care about is using ideology to paint themselves as pure and the rest of us who don't agree with them as stained, less perfect human beings. Not for the purpose of elevating the moral fiber of America, but for the purpose of dividing America through the heart so they can stay in power. That's why they do it, and you know it. So, here's the problem. It wouldn't be good at any time to have a country ruled by somebody who was primarily devoted to concentrated wealth, abusive, unaccountable power, and divisive ideology. That's not very good any time. But it is spectacularly unsuited for a time that requires us to think, because we have novel challenges that don't have ideological answers and that require change. What do you get instead? If all you care about is concentrating wealth and power and being as ideological as possible, you get the following things. You get more inequality. You get an unlimited devotion to the status quo for the same reason that Willie Sutton robbed banks. That's where the money is. You get a profoundly divided country and abuse of power in government, and you get real bad policies. So that's how we got where we are.
If there's a debate going on in this country right now, can we succeed as a nation where a shrinking number of people are doing really, really well, but a growing number are struggling to get by? Or are we better off when everybody gets a fair shot? And everybody does a fair share. This is not about a few people doing well. We want people to do well. That's great. But it's about giving everybody the chance to do well. That's the essence of America. That's what the American dream's about. In this country, prosperity has never trickled down from the wealthy few. Prosperity has always come from the bottom up, from a strong and growing middle class. And yet, we keep on having the same argument with folks who don't seem to understand how it is that America got built. So let me ask you, what's the better way to make our economy stronger? Do we give another $50,000 in tax breaks to every millionaire and billionaire in the country?
No!
Or should we make investments in education and research and health care and our veterans? And Florida, I've told you where I stand. So now it's time for members of Congress to tell you where they stand. In the next few weeks, we're going to vote on something we call the Buffett Rule. Very simple. If you make more than $1 million a year, then what the rule says is you should pay the same percentage of your income in taxes as middle-class families do. You shouldn't get special tax breaks. You shouldn't be able to get special loopholes.
Given the increasing diversity of America's population, the dangers of sectarianism are greater than ever. Whatever we once were, we are no longer a Christian nation, at least not just. We are also a Jewish nation, a Muslim nation, and a Buddhist nation, and a Hindu nation, and a nation of non-believers. And even if we did have only Christians in our midst, if we expelled every non-Christian from the United States of America, whose Christianity would we teach in the schools? Would it be James Dobson's or Al Sharpton's? Which passages of Scripture should guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay, and that eating shellfish is an abomination? Or we could go with Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Or should we just stick to the Sermon on the Mount? A passage that is so radical that it's doubtful that our own Defense Department would survive its application. So before we get carried away, let's read our Bibles now. Folks haven't been reading their Bible. Which brings me to my second point. Democracy demands that the religiously motivated translate their concerns into universal rather than religion-specific values. What do I mean by this? It requires that their proposals be subject to argument and amenable to reason. Now, I may be opposed to abortion for religious reasons, to take one example, but if I seek to pass a law banning the practice, I can't simply point to the teachings of my church or evoke God's will. I have to explain why abortion violates some principle that is accessible to people of all faiths, including those with no faith at all. Now, this is going to be difficult for some who believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, as many evangelicals do. But in a pluralistic society, we have no choice. Politics depends on our ability to persuade each other of common aims based on a common reality. It involves compromise, the art of what's possible. And at some fundamental level, religion doesn't allow for compromise. It's the art of the impossible. If God's spoken, then followers are expected to live up to God's edicts, regardless of the consequences. Now, to base one's own life on such uncompromising commitments may be sublime, but to base our policy making on such commitments would be a dangerous thing. And if you doubt that, let me just give you an example. We all know the story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham's ordered by God to offer up his only son. Without argument, he takes Isaac up to the mountaintop, he binds them to the altar, raises his knife, prepares to act as God commanded. Now, we know things worked out. You know, God sends down angel to intercede at the very last minute. Abraham passes God's test of devotion. But it's fair to say that if any of us leaving this church saw Abraham on the roof of a building raising his knife, we would, at the very least, call the police and expect the Department of Children and Family Services to take Isaac away from Abraham. We would do so because we don't hear what Abraham hears. We don't see what Abraham sees. And so the best we can do is act in accordance with those things that we all see and that we all hear, be it common laws or basic reason. So we have some work to do here. But I am hopeful that we can bridge the gap that exists and overcome the prejudices that all of us to one degree or another bring to this debate. And I have faith that millions of believing Americans want that to happen. No matter how religious they may be or may not be, people are tired of seeing faith used as a tool of attack. They don't want faith used to belittle or to divide, because in the end, that's not how they think about faith in their own lives.
Talk more about the separation of church and state, and if that line is getting hazier, I'm joined now by Daniel Faraci. He's the director, Grassroots Political Consulting, LLC, and A.J. Johnson, Development Director for American Atheists. Welcome to the both of you. Daniel, I'm going to start with you. Too much religious talk in politics today.
I don't believe so. We've had an integral amount of religion in politics since our founding fathers, who were a mix of agnostic, Judeo-Christian, natural law, common law, put that all together. And then you fast forward up to brief historical context of the last few decades on both sides of the aisle, the moral majority on the right in the 80s, to even transcending from a wartime and some scandal environment. Clinton used it, embraced religion even more than W in the Southern strategy of what he used. And then you came through this current decade where we face issues like partial birth abortion, Defense of Marriage Act, Catholics and what they're dealing with the health care bill. And there are a lot of religious issues, whether right or wrong, that are an integral part of the American political process right now.
AJ, what do you think about that? How much would you say religion dictates today the political discussion? I mean, as you just mentioned, contraception, gay marriage, a lot of these social issues and a lot of airtime dedicated to these subjects. Is there too much religious talk from our politicians?
Yes.
What do you think?
I definitely think there's far too much religious talk and not enough talk on the real issues. Like someone mentioned in the earlier segment, we have so many Americans without health care, so many without jobs. Every second that people spend talking about religion is seconds spent not talking about the real issues.
And what are the real issues, would you say, are being overlooked with more time being spent on these social issues?
Well, I think that the real issues are the economy right now. As far as I'm concerned, getting Americans working and getting veterans home and in good jobs are the issues that I would see politicians working on.
And some say that religion is being politicized because, especially now, we have the GOP, the race to be the next nominee, and that they are catering to a lot of America that do see religion as important. Daniel, is it possible that religion is being politicized and that candidates are using it as a tool to win votes?
both sides of the aisle do it, as I've said. I mean, the GOP has more of a Catholic base and you know, a lot of Southern religious Baptists and other conservatives, but the left is doing it as well. I mean, you see the swing through from congressional to President Obama, Reverend Sharpton, all going through African-American churches in South Carolina, embracing their religion and speaking of it through various speeches and various contexts of talking through different issues, especially even now with the health care bill and Catholics and different segments of society. So, I mean, you could really say this is a bipartisan issue, politicizing religion in American politics. And another huge issue, of course, being the Israeli issue and the support for Israel and how that transcends into the Jewish, Christian, and Catholic communities. So both sides of the aisle are doing it, and they're going to do it throughout this election cycle.
AJ, do you agree that it is a bipartisan issue? What do you think about that?
I do think that both sides of the aisle do have this problem, but I think that the right side of the aisle certainly utilizes their religiosity to forward issues like opposing gay marriage and gay rights, even if it's not really contingent with their theology. They kind of use it as a tool in a way that I don't think that the left does. The left, if it does use it at all, uses it to connect to voters and to maybe bring out certain demographics versus using it as a ploy to get certain people to think certain ways about issues.
And AJ, you just said that most of this does come from the religious right. A lot of it we did hear from Rick Santorum, a couple of examples there in the story that we aired just a moment ago. But Rick Santorum is out of the race now. Now a lot of people are focusing on Mitt Romney, and he apparently is not immune to this. Here is a discussion regarding his place in religion today. It was on CNN. Let's take a listen.
The question that needs to be asked of Governor Romney, do you agree with the teaching of your church? If you do, that homosexual acts are offensive to God, then why have you made the face of your campaign someone who engages in conduct that your own church says is offensive to God?
But Brian,
if you don't agree with your church, then how can you expect the evangelical base to support you?
But we're talking about the separation of church and state here.
So clearly, he's bringing into the debate here the fact that one of his advisors is gay, and for some reason, this is not seen as appropriate. There's this religious link in this scenario. What do you think about that?
I think it was just a pretty bogus interview right there. Just because you are a part of one religious sect or doctrine or creed or another doesn't mean that you agree with every single part of the religious principle that's offered, whether you're Baptist, Catholic, Mormon. I mean, look at Catholics on birth control. The overwhelming majority of Catholics believe in the use of contraceptives and other, you know, apparatuses and don't go with the original teaching of the church. So just because you're a part of one religion doesn't mean that you have to lump in every single thing as your personal value. So I just don't find that to be a credible argument.
All right, AJ, I'm going to let you respond to that.
Sure, I agree that just because you're part of a certain church or religion doesn't mean that you should agree with or do necessarily agree with all of their positions. However, I would love to see politicians come out, especially Mitt Romney and the Mormon Church, and say what specifically he doesn't agree with and what specifically he would do to, you know, act out against his church if he is comfortable talking about that, which we know he is not.
Well, if that's the case with Mitt Romney, then we'd love to see Barack Obama speak about Reverend Wright and the church he was in and all the very, very extreme positions that were taken and espoused right from the pulpit and have answered those questions as were not answered back in 2008 cycle. So I agree. I think they both should be, if they're both going to espouse it and attest to those religions and churches they're a part of, then let them both get on record and talk about if they want to be the leader of the free country, they need to talk about where they stand on these things.
Now, at the center of this argument is this whole separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. And do you think that we, in fact, have that today?
Well, separation of church and state is a great misnomer as well. It was a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a group of religious activists basically espousing how we were not to have one established religion like the English did at the time for this country. And we were supposed to, in constitutional principles, the free exercise establishment of religion allows any religion as long as it doesn't incite violence and other things like that, to be a part of American culture. So, you know, that is the heart and soul of the argument there. And the way that it has been manipulated to a core of the Constitution and in the Declaration, as many Americans think, is just a fraud.
But there is, Daniel, a growing movement, this growing secular movement that wants religion out of politics. And that poll that I mentioned earlier in that story shows that for the first time since 2001, more Americans think there is too much religious talk in politics, and compared to those that think there is too little. AJ, what do you think about this poll?
Sure. Just a bit of clarification there. The Thomas Jefferson letter was to the Danbury Baptists. And he was actually trying to tell them that he was trying to keep church and state separate to protect both the government and the church. But I would agree with the poll. I do think that there's far too much religious speak, and again, that it takes time away from the real issues.
And I would assume, AJ, that you would vote for an atheist. Would that matter to you?
Of course I would vote for an atheist. It would not matter to me one way or the other. I do think that they would be more aligned with my positions. Certainly there's no secular reason to be against gay marriage or denying women health care, so I imagine that they would probably have many similar positions off the bat, but it would not be relevant to me. I would vote on the issues.
And what about you? Is it relevant to you? Would you vote for an atheist?
For me, personally, it'd be a problem because I don't espouse the same personal belief system, so... That being aside, but I want to go back to earlier point, talking about the polling. I've seen it go both ways. It kind of feeds back into a point of, although I'd articulate it different, what's a real issue and not, about AJ's point about the economy. And basically, there are, that's why Mitch Daniels on the right side of the aisle probably had it best, the governor of Indiana, talking about a truce doctrine on social issues and dealing with the fiscal tsunami, as he called it, that we have presently to take care of. And I think that's why even the poll you indicated is how it stands, too much religion, too much of this and that in politics. I think people really want progress, solutions, and things to be done on the economy in this country as the central core issue, and that's why we're seeing the sentiment of voters be like that right now.
And I think you're correct in that way. People that I talked to over that Reason rally said that they were sick of hearing these kinds of issues like contraception, gay marriage, when we have this economic crisis on our hands, yet you are hearing a lot of this rhetoric coming from the GOP candidates. But you said earlier that you wouldn't vote for an atheist. Why is that? Do you think that you, in order to be a good person, to have morals, that you need to be religious?
No, atheism is a belief system, just like any other religion. It's a belief in no God, just like there's a belief in a God from more religious individuals. So it's not a discriminatory thing. It's just not a personal thing I agree with.
All right, AJ, I'll let you have the last word there.
Well, I would just say atheism is to religion as off is to a television channel. It is actually not a religion in and of itself, nor is it a belief system in and of itself. It's the lack thereof.
All right, well, thank you both for coming on the show. We're out of time. An interesting debate there. That was Daniel Faraci. He is the director of Grassroots Political Consulting, LLC, and AJ Johnson, the development director for American Atheist.
Well, what do you think, Blog Talk Mom? Are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, this was great. It hit from so many different viewpoints, and if a person would just open their mind and listen, it was very good. You have to hear, really hear what someone's saying from the broad spectrum of reality, you know, and I enjoyed this. It was very good. It brought out a lot of things that we need to be aware of, and I do think that many times that things like the religious issue is more a distraction. It's more like I mentioned before about the forces that are there, the darkness, the not just saying the devil or evil, but the forces of power and greed, they're there, and they're working, and they use certain things to distract people that people like to argue over. People, they argue because they really don't have anything any power over it. So they feel like they have a little bit of power as long as they're arguing, and they're missing the real message. Like, I did not, I understood what President Obama was saying, but again, if we would go to the teachings of Christ and the when he preached about the Sermon on the Mount, we would be part of an eternal kingdom that will last forever. And that is the most important. But he made a very good point in that that was, you can't apply that. That is something that happens within the heart of people. They are born again. They are born into that kingdom. You can't legislate that. You can't make a set of rules that people have to go by in a country that is so diversified as has been brought out. So thank you again, Starla and Wild Bill, for an excellent program. A lot of work was put into this, and I enjoyed it very much. I hope others did.
Well, if we don't have any other callers, we're just going to say good night, and we hope to see you back here next week. And remember, part two. Thanks a lot. Good night.